Welcome to the Talking Information Center short story program, being read from here at the Talking Information Center. My name is Danny V. Today reading the short story, Take Me for a Ride, written by the author Michael Mallory. And now for the Talking Information Center short story program. The story took up most of the front page of the Los Angeles Herald Express. Bugsy Siegel murdered. The headline screamed, daring any reader to notice that Finland was chosen to host the 1952 Olympics 5 years hence, or that the Senate battled through a contentious all-night session. Would stamping Bugsy's passport to the afterlife make Los Angeles a safer place to live? Jim Beckley doubted it. As he was perusing the inside of the paper, a knock rattled the glass of his office door, which was on the second floor of an old building in the neighborhood of Los Feliz. Opening it, Jim cried, "Good God, Sanders," upon seeing the shortish, muscular man standing in the hallway. "Hiya, Sarge," Osgood Goody Sanders said, grinning at his former platoon mate. He held out his hand, which Jim shook and then used to pull him into the office. Corporal Goody Sanders was the kind of soldier every unit needed, the guy who could keep any motor vehicle running. He had been the one who figured out how to keep the tank's treads from getting bogged down in the mud in Europe by reinforcing them with wooden planks. "Have a seat, Corporal," Jim said, motioning him to the only one in the office, not behind his desk. "What are you up to these days?" "Got my own garage in Silver Lake," Sanders replied. "I got cars coming in and out all the time." "There's a shock." "Yeah, I always wanted my own place. I worked at a gas station for 8 months, and I saved every nickel I could. I built up a reputation, too. Then finally I found a place and I opened for business." "That's great," Jim said. "As you can see, things have changed a little for me. The last thing I expected I'd be doing once I finally decamped was turning into Philip Marlowe, but it turns out that I have a knack for it." "Yeah, that's why I'm here." Jim studied the compatriot's blunt, square face. "You have a problem?" "You could say that. Somebody brought in a car last week. A real beauty. Like nothing I've ever seen before. The guy said the shifting was getting rough, and he heard about me from somebody. Anyway, it was a 1943 Packard 130 with all the accessories. The damn thing nearly came with its own kitchen and latrine." "Wait a minute," Goody said. "You said a 1943 Packard?" Sanders grinned and nodded. "That's what I said. And with this guy, his name's Claude Descanso, told me that, I gave him a little hoarse laugh, too, and asked what kind of con he was trying to pull. One did not have to be an automotive expert to know that no autos of any kind were built in America during the war, freeing up the car makers to concentrate exclusively on the war effort." "What was the guy's name again?" Jim asked. "Descanso. Claude Descanso," Sanders replied. "He looked like he should be named Claude Descanso. Tall, thin, slicked back hair, pencil mustache, a little prissy. I know if this Claude Descanso was trying to take you for a ride, he wasn't being very clever about it. And I told him that, but he kept insisting I should take a look at the car, whether I believed his claim or not. He said he'd give me all the details later, and since he was willing to pay my money in advance, I agreed. And Sarge, I'm telling you, that was one sweet piece of road eater. Here, let me show you." Reaching into his coat pocket, Sanders pulled out a black and white photograph and handed it to Jim. It showed a luxury vehicle in two-tone paint with plenty of chrome and the signature Packard grille and hood ornament. "That was taken in my shop." "Nice," said Jim. "It's even better in person. The sides are pine tree green, and the top of the hood is a kind of sea foam, with the sun, yellow tire sidewalls. Long story short, the car needed some tranny work, like the guy intimated, but otherwise it was in tip-top shape. It was closing time, last Thursday, when I called Descanso to tell him it was ready, and he said he'd be by in the morning. That was when I mentioned that I'd seen parts in the engine that I'd never seen before. He smiled and finally filled me in on the car's secret. Sanders stopped to pull out a pack of cigarettes and light one. Don't keep me in suspense, Goody. Sorry. What do you know about Argentina? It's somewhere down south. Well, its government didn't seem to want to get into the war. Neither did I, but I didn't have much to say in the matter, Jim thought. It seems both us, I mean the U.S., and England, were pressing the president of Argentina to cut off his ties with the Axis and side with us. As an incentive, hell, a bribe, Roosevelt offered to send El Presidente a one-of-a-kind American luxury car, a make-in model no one else on Earth had. He personally ordered a Packard to make one car and throw in the kitchen sink, but all on the QT. No one was supposed to know this was going on. When the car was finished, film of it being test-driven was sent down to Argentina. And guess what? El Presidente actually did break it off with Hitler and Tojo. I have to assume that the car was never delivered to him. Apparently, Roosevelt was holding out for the other boot to drop and for Argentina to declare that it was on the side of the Allies. But that didn't happen immediately. A couple of months later, after telling Schickelberger to take a flying leap out of a Messerschmitt, El Presidente resigns. The guy who took over as president waited more than a year before signing up with the good guys. Then 2 weeks after that, Roosevelt dropped dead, and the whole secret deal fell apart. The car goes into storage, the war ends with a big kaboom, and that's that. Did Descanso say how he got ownership of the car? Jim asked. No. In fact, he specifically stated that was the one question he would not answer. But you believed his story? Well, whether I did or not doesn't really matter at this point. Descanso showed up the next morning, right as I was unlocking the garage door, all smiles. That ended when I got the door open. Sarge, the car was gone. Gone? Like it was never there. The garage door was padlocked from the inside, just like I left it. There's a back door that goes into an alley, and it was locked from the inside, too. I leave through the front door to the office, which I lock from the outside. The only way that car could have gotten out of there was if somebody came in through the front, unlocked the padlock on the garage door, drove out, relocked the garage door, and then exited from the front again. But I'm the only one with the keys. There isn't another set anywhere. What did Descanso do when you told him his car was missing? Jim asked. Oh, wow, Sarge. He blew a gasket. He started accusing me of theft, and he said he was going to sue me. I didn't know what to do. Then I came across your ad in the Yellow Pages, and I saw that you were now a detective. That's the only bit of good luck I've had in the last few days. Have you heard from him since? No, but I expect to any time. Have you gone to the police? No, I imagine telling the cops that story and figured all they'd do would be to toss me in the tank and tell me to sleep it off. What do you expect me to do, Goody? Well, find the car for one thing, Sarge. If you can also figure out how someone got through all the locks and got the thing out and then locked the place back up without keys, that would be helpful too. Jim Beckley thought in silence for a moment. What he should do was take Goody Sanders out for a beer and then tell him his case sounded incredible, maybe even unsolvable. But he and Goody had been through a lot together. He was the kind of friend you made in life or death situation. Finally, he said, all right, Goody, I'll take you on as a client, but on one condition. Name it. That you call me Jim. Sarge is folded up in my closet at home. All right, Jim. You don't need money up front, do you? Let's wait on that until I can get your client contract written up. Right now, how about me taking me to your garage so that I can look around? With Sanders' blue coupe in the lead, the two convoyed in separate cars down to Sunset Boulevard, where the garage was located. It was a small establishment, set back from the street to make room for a parking lot, which was nearly full. The lot was surrounded by a cyclone fence topped with barbed wire. You can't be too careful, Sanders said. You didn't mention the fence, Jim said. This has a locking gate, too, I presume. Right. I forgot about that. So whoever took the car had to first get through this gate, then into the garage itself. And you're certain there isn't another set of keys? Positive. Okay, let's go. The inside of Goody Sanders' garage looked like the inside of any garage. There were tools and parts strewn everywhere, grease on the concrete floor, a girly calendar which Jim presumed were mandatory before a business license for an auto shop would be granted in the city. There was only one car inside, a dark red Nash Ambassador, which had much of its engine missing. Taking out the photo Sanders had given him, Jim held it up against the building until he lined up the camera position. It didn't tell him anything except that the photo had indeed been taken inside the garage, and the luxury car filled up most of it. You don't have any employees? Jim asked. No, just me. You think someone might have to use a lockpick? It's technically possible, but the thief would have had to pick the padlock on the gate, open it, come in, pick the front door lock, go in, pick the lock on the gate, pick the padlock on the garage door, open it, drive the car out, then go back and lock up everything again, including the front gate lock, before driving away. Which raises one big question. How did the thief start the ignition? I left the key inside the car, Goody said. I didn't want to lose it. That was pretty dumb. You weren't expecting it to get stolen, Jim said. But maybe it's a good thing you did. How can it be good? Well, think about it. There's no way the thief could know you left the ignition key in the car when he broke through the first lock, so he had to have some other plan to start it. There's always hot wiring, or popping out the ignition and then starting it up with a screwdriver. Anyone with a good knowledge of cars could have done either one of those things. That's what I'm saying. Whoever took it must have had a good knowledge of cars and engines. Another garage owner? Have you had any trouble lately with another mechanic? No, Sanders said, shaking his head. I haven't been open long enough to make enemies. Okay, Jim said. I'm going to need to talk to this Descanso guy. I've got his number on the desk. Sanders walked to the small desk, shoved up against the far wall, and began rifling through the pile of papers stacked on top of it, nearly obscuring the old candlestick phone that rested on the edge. It's here somewhere, he called back, unless I stuck it in the pocket of my overalls. Jim fished out a business card, and he carried it over to his friend. I'll tell you what. You find the number, and you call me. And if the guy shows up in person, try to keep him here, and then call me. Will do, sir. I mean, Jim. I'll give you one of my cards, too. Once more, he searched through the papers, finally muttering, I know I have one some here someplace. Instead of waiting, Jim Beckley pulled out a small notepad and pen and wrote down the number on the phone. I can't say this is going to be a snap, Goody, he said, but we'll get this figured out. He shook the man's hand again before taking his leave. Back in his car, a two-door Chevrolet Fleetmaster that he couldn't imagine anyone wanting to steal, he thought about his last words to Sanders, and he added aloud, I just can't see how. After closing up his office for the day, Jim went home to the small house he shared with Della Hampton. As far as their neighbors knew, they were a happily married couple. The happy part was true. It was the married part that wasn't. Della had been married to another ex-GI who had managed to get himself murdered. That was how she and Jim became acquainted. Not exactly a Hollywood meet-cute moment. As for Jim, his divorce decree was now 5 months old, and the knowledge that he was more than halfway responsible for it made him gun-shy about putting on another ring. The two of them were comfortable the way things stood. Now a break from the story. This is the Talking Information Center's short story program being read from here at the Talking Information Center. And this is the short story, Take Me for a Ride. This short story was written by the author, Michael Mallory. And now, back to the story. The aroma of meatloaf permeated the house when Jim walked in, "Smells great," he told Della, tossing his hat on the front seat of the chair, taking off his jacket and draping it over the back, and undoing his tie. "You're not going to make me eat something green, though, are you?"
"Not tonight," Della replied.
"Tonight is yellow. Summer squash."
"Hmm," he grumbled. Like so many returned soldiers, Jim Beckley was a meat and potatoes man, though she had fixed something with leaves once that he had halfway enjoyed. After they had finished dinner, they jointly washed and dried the dishes, with Della subconsciously humming a song. Jim liked to hear her hum and sing. When she finished, he said, "I got a new case today."
"Not a dangerous one, I hope."
"No, but a strange one. What do you know about Argentina?"
"Isn't that where all the escaped Nazis are hiding?"
"That I don't know, but listen to this." And he related to her the details of the case, as told to him by Goody Sanders. And when he was finished, he added, "I don't know how much of that is true, particularly about FDR bribing the head of Argentina, but I do know there's no packet, 1943, or otherwise, in Goody's garage."
"Seems like it's too bizarre a story to be made up," Della said.
"Would you like me to go to the library on Monday and do some research into politics in Argentina?"
"That would be swell."
The two spent Sunday at the Los Angeles Zoo, where Jim absently wondered if the gorilla in the cage might have a better shot at figuring out this crackpot case than he did. But he didn't go into this business just to quit when things became difficult. On Monday morning, Jim went into his office while Della took the bus to Hollywood, which had a large public library branch. When she appeared in his office a couple of hours later, he was studying the photo that Goody had given him of the car.
"You'll be happy to know," she began, "that your friend's story has a basis in fact."
"You discovered something about the car?" he asked. Della pulled a notebook out of her purse, and she glanced at the pages.
"The car? No. As for Argentina, though, it was officially neutral for most of the war, though it leaned toward supporting Germany. The president at the time was Pedro Pablo Ramirez, and he broke it off with the Axis in January of 1944. He soon thereafter resigned, and his vice president, General Eldamiro Ferro, took over on March 26, 1945, 6 days after FDR was sworn in for his fourth term. Argentina officially declared war on Germany and Japan, which means that Roosevelt could have renewed his promise of the car to General Farrell. But before long, Farrell was replaced as president by someone named Juan Perón, and he's still there.
Who was a guy named Farrell running a South American country anyhow? That sounds more like a Boston cop.
I wondered about that too, so I looked it up. His grandfather had come from Ireland.
Well, you were too busy.
So I was, but is any of it any help?
Sure, it makes Goody's story sound a little less screwy, but it doesn't tell me how a car could vanish from a locked garage. I really need to talk to this Descanso character, and I don't know how to get a hold of him.
Wasn't your friend supposed to call you with his number?
He said so, but he probably forgot. Once he gets working on an engine, everything else just completely goes away.
And here, Jim pulled the notepad from his pocket, and he dialed the number for the garage that he had written down. The phone at the other end rang unanswered.
Why would he not be there, he asked, hanging up.
Maybe he stepped out for lunch.
Maybe.
I think I should go over there again. I'll drop you off at home on the way.
Why don't you drop me off at the Owl Drugs on Vermont instead? I'll find my way home.
Is there something I should know about? Jim asked wearily.
He and Della not only shared the house, but increasingly the same bed.
Only if you lose sleep over the particular brand of face powder that I like, she replied.
Jim dropped her off in front of the drugstore, and then he proceeded to the Sanders garage.
When he got there, he saw the front gate was closed, but it was locked.
Going through, but it was not locked.
Going through the gate,
He went up to the door, which was also unlocked. The garage was dark inside. "Hello, Goody," Jim called, and received no answer. There was enough sunlight bleeding in for him to find the light switch, which turned on the overhead lights. Looking around him, Jim saw that the Nash was still there, but was now reassembled. And then he saw something else. A man was lying on the oily concrete in the middle of the shop. Approaching him cautiously, Jim knelt and checked the pulse. Finding none, he very carefully rolled the man over. It was not Goody Sanders. Neither was it someone who matched Goody's description of Claude Descanso. Only one thing seemed certain. Whatever made the bloody, greasy dent on the man's head was the cause of death. Going to Sanders' desk, Jim took out his handkerchief and used it to pick up the candlestick phone while employing his necktie as protection against getting his fingerprints on the earpiece or smudging those already there. Dialing zero, he instructed the operator to connect him with the Police Homicide Bureau. Once there, he asked for Detective Rand Moreland, who last year headed up the investigation into the murder of Della's husband. When Moreland answered, Jim said, "This is Jim Beckley. Remember me?" "Hell yes," the voice at the other end said. "I heard you somehow got a license and you went into business for yourself." "That's right. And guess what? I just stumbled over my second dead body." "I guess you have. I haven't been in this racket long enough to know that gumshoes normally don't protect their clients by remaining silent," Rand Moreland told Jim as the two sat in the detective's office at City Hall. Jim had just finished explaining much of the case as he felt comfortable disclosing, but he described the missing car only as valuable without revealing its background. "I thought I was protecting Goody by letting you know what's going on before you find him and start grilling him," Jim replied. "You don't happen to know where he lives, do you?" Jim shook his head. "I've only been to his place of business." The detective's phone rang. "Moreland," he growled into it. "Okay, good. What have you got?" After listening for a minute, he said, "Good work," and he hung up. "They've identified the body as Lyman Hundley, 41 years old, unmarried. He worked for Republic Studios in the special effects department. No criminal record, as far as anyone can tell." "Did your friend Sanders ever mention a Lyman Hundley?" "No, but he was another customer of Goody's. There was a car in the garage, an old Nash." "And you know nothing about this Claude Descanso?" "Believe me, I wish I could tell you where to find him, because he seems to be at the center of all this. I'll put someone on him, and if someone we can dig something up, we will. So how do you like gumshoeing?" "All right. Della's the one who nudged me into it." "Della? Oh, right, Hampton's wife. She's a real traffic stopper. How is she?" "Fine." "Okay, don't tell me what's going on between you two," Moreland said with a grin. The detective's phone rang. "Yep," he barked. "Oh, wow. All right, thanks." Dropping the receiver into the cradle, he said, "The reporters are on the way up. I don't think you should want to be a part of this." "Neither do I," Jim said. "I'll slip out the back. If you find your buddy Sanders before we do, let me know." "Right." Jim left the building, and he went back to his office, where he tried calling Goody's garage again. This time it picked up. "Hello, who's this?" a voice answered, not Goody's. "Is Mr. Sanders there?" Jim asked. "No, who's calling?" "I have a car there for a fuel pump repair," Jim lied. "I wanted to know if it's done." "Who is it?" a voice in the background asked. "A customer, Lieutenant," the man on the phone called back. "Police," Jim thought. "You sound busy. I'll call back later." After hanging up, he pulled out the photo of the car, and he began to study it once more, as though it would somehow reveal a clue. It didn't, though there was something wrong with the image, something he couldn't put his finger on. Slipping it into his breast pocket, he reached into a desk drawer, and he pulled out the Luger that he'd brought back from Germany. He didn't like carrying a gun, but it had been a fact of his life for the past 5 years. His wife, Carol, had absolutely hated the sight of that automatic pistol, which contributed to her decision to leave him. The Luger, the larger consideration, of course, was her growing fearfulness of his moodiness and his drinking, both symptoms of the memories of the war, which continued to haunt him, though slightly less frequent now. He spent the next several minutes cleaning the Luger, and was still holding the gun when his office door burst open. "Hey, hey, hey!" Goody Sanders shouted, throwing up his hands, as he saw what appeared to be Jim training the pistol on him. A bandage was wrapped around his right index finger. "You can put your hands down," Jim said, opening his desk drawer and sliding the gun back inside. "I was just cleaning it." "Phew," Sanders whistled. "What did you do to your finger?" "I cut it on a piece of glass. But never mind that. Something's going on in my garage. There's cops all over the place." "I know. I was there this morning. The gate was unlocked, so I went in, and I found the front door unlocked. Then I found a corpse on the floor." "Descanso?" "No. Somebody named Lyman Hundley. Do you know him?" "Yeah, I know him. He's dead? Crud. Hey, the cops don't think I did it, do they?" "Well, they certainly'd like to talk to you, Goody. I called not long ago, and they were still there." "Didn't you say anything then?" "No, I didn't go inside. I was out most of the day buying parts, and when I got back and I saw all those patrol cars, I just kept going, and it came straight here." "The longer you stay out of sight, the more convinced the police will be that you had something to do with Hundley's death." "Who was he, Goody?" Goody Sanders flopped down on the guest chair, pulled out a handkerchief, and mopped his sweaty face. "You might as well know now," he said. "He's the real owner of that car." "So Claude Descanso was just an agent?" "There is no Claude Descanso. He's a shadow figure, Lai and me made up." "A shadow figure?" "Yeah, he's not real. He's just a name, like an alias." "Shadow?" Jim said, pulling the photo of the car back out again and staring at it. "That's it. Something about this picture struck me as not quite right, but I couldn't figure it out. It's obvious now. Even with the overhead lights, the car should have cast some kind of shadow on the floor, but it doesn't. It's like it's floating in air. The picture's a fake, isn't it?" "The picture's not a fake." Sanders pulled out a pack of smokes and lit one. "But the car is." "What are you up to, Goody?" Sanders sighed. "Okay. Do you know what a hanging miniature is?" "No. They're models of things like rooms or buildings, and they're used in films. If you don't want to build a full-sized castle, say you make a model of it and then hang it by the wires in front of a camera. When lined up right, it looks like it's part of the real set. They're a lot cheaper than building a full-sized fake castle on a hill. Lai's job at the studio was to make models like that, as well as bridges to be blown up or cars to fly over cliffs. He was good, too. His stuff looked real. That Packard in the photo is a 2-foot model that he strung up and positioned for the camera so that it looked like it was really sitting in the shop. And it looks absolutely real, except that it doesn't cast a shadow. Yeah, well, in the movies, the shots go by so fast that you don't get a chance to notice. All right, now I know how a car could disappear from a locked building. But what's the point of all this? The point was to try and keep me and Lai from getting his legs broken or worse. Lai and me, we go all the way back to high school. I hadn't seen him for years because I was in uniform. I don't have to tell you that, but he managed to stay out and keep working because of the necessary industry label they put over the film business. He was making good money, too, but he had one problem, the gambling bug. He got in way over his head, and he started borrowing money from guys that he shouldn't have. He was desperate to get cash and to pay off his debts, so he came to me with this scheme to try and sell a car to somebody. He made up the story about Roosevelt and the president of Argentina. Some drinking buddy of his who was a writer at the studio and into world politics, helped him with the details. He even had a mark lined up, a producer named Carlson, who was the kind of guy who always tried to show up everyone else by having somebody they didn't. So the only car of its kind in the world, worth who knows how much, that was the perfect pitch. And the photo was taken to convince him. Yeah, the idea was to get half of the money up front and then have Claude Descanso mysteriously disappear with the car to be never seen again, because just half of the money Lau was asking for was still pretty damn good. But then something happened, and the deal got queered. I don't know how, but all I know is Lau was in a panic because he had to get some dough really fast. Out of desperation, he came up with a new scheme. He'd offer to pay for the car to the guy who loaned him money in the first place as a payment. But there was no car, Jim said. Right, but we had to make the guy think there was a car. We figured the best way to do that was to get somebody else involved who also believed the car was real, but that he had it stolen, and I guarantee Lai's loan shark that he was searching for it. In other words, me, Jim said. Yeah, I'd heard that you'd wanted to become a private dick and yet you had, so you seemed perfect. Now a break from the story. This is the Talking Information Center short story program being read from here at the Talking Information Center. And this is the short story, Take Me for a Ride, written by the author Michael Mallory. And now, back to the story. Goody, if this was a movie, by now, I'd have walked out and demanded my money back from the cashier. How do you expect to get away with this? What do you think was going to happen when the buyer, no matter who it was, found out that the car existed only as a toy? And why not simply tell me that the car had been stolen from the lot? Why go to all the trouble of creating a mystery that nobody could solve? Because I figured the longer it took you to investigate, the longer it would keep Lie healthy, Sanders replied. The more impossible I made it seemed the better, because there was no way you were going to find a car that didn't exist. I also know that you're kind of guy who just doesn't give up. So if you reported back to the loan shark every week that you were still on the case and refused to drop it, that would be one more week Lai had to try and come up with the money for real. I'm not saying it was a genius plan, but Lai was desperate. Sounds to me like the creditor got wind of what you were doing and took care of Hundley. Do you know who he is? Lai wouldn't say, but maybe it wasn't the shark that killed him. Maybe it was the producer after all. I just don't know. You are going to talk to the police about this, you know. Sanders said nothing as he stubbed out his cigarette in the tray on Jim's desk. Look, Goody, I know one of these homicide detectives, and he's a good guy. Could you talk to him then? Sanders asked. Straighten things out with him as a friend? With a sigh, Jim picked up his phone and placed a call to homicide division. When he got Moreland on the line, he said, Hi, Detective. It's Jim Beckley again. I have Goody, that is, Osgood Sanders, with me in the office. He's afraid to come down for fear that he might be arrested. No, I don't think he killed Hundley. Sure, hold on. He handed the phone to Sanders, who took it reluctantly. Hello? Yes, this is Osgood Sanders. When? Tomorrow? Well, okay. What time? All right, I'll be there. My address? 214 North Virgil. Jim jotted the address down on a piece of paper, and he also noticed that Sanders gave his shop off phone number instead of a home number. All right, thank you. Oh, and do you know when your troops will be finished at my place? Oh, okay, thanks. He handed the phone back to Jim. I told you it wouldn't be that grueling, Jim said, re-cradling the receiver. Yeah, and the cops are done at the shop, which is even better. Once Sanders had taken his leave, Jim started to make notes on a sheet of paper. What it amounted to was a scheme, fated to end badly. Carlson, Jim muttered, reading over his notes. Obviously, he would not get very far, showing up in the metro at Culver City and asking to see a producer. Maybe he would even get the guy on the phone. It seemed a little after four. Surely even a producer would still be at work. He called the operator for a number of the studio, and once there, he wended his way through the secretary after secretary until he ended up in the office of Ralph Carlson Productions. "Mr. Carlson's not here," the woman at the other end of the line said. "Who is this, please?" "My name is Jim Beckley, and I'm calling regarding a 1943 Packard." "A 1943 Packard? Didn't they stop making any kind of car after Pearl Harbor?" "Yes, but when will Mr. Carlson be back?" "He's expected home the first week of September." "Sorry?" "He's in London. He's over there in England setting up overseas studio." "How long has he been in England?" "He left last week." "I see. He calls in regularly," the secretary said. "Shall I leave a message?" "No, thanks. I'll call back in September." Jim hung up. If Carlson had been in England for a week, he couldn't have killed Hundley. That also explained why the original deal fell through. The mysterious loan shark was now the sole prime suspect. But who was he? It was becoming clear that this case would not be wrapped up quickly, if ever. And Jim was still working off the clock. From his desk, he pulled out a folder of printed work agreements and filled in his share of the information necessary for taking Goody on as an official client. He started to address an envelope for it, but then he stopped. Maybe it would be better to take the agreement over to Goody in person, and also to let him know about Carlson's trip. Picking the phone up, he dialed Della and told her to do some legwork, and it would probably be late for dinner. "Better yet," he said, "why don't you take the night off? Go see a movie, maybe, or get a bite out. I'll do the same." "You'll see a movie?" she asked in a goofy voice. "No, Gracie, I'll get something to eat at a lunch counter." "Whatever you're doing, Jim, be careful. You know, there are times when I think you really care." And in her sweetest voice, Della repeated a phrase that she'd heard from the musician she used to sing with in her former life, which made Jim laugh raucously. He hung up, glad they were not on a party line. She could make him laugh. She also sang, cooked, and when fixed up, she made Gene Tierney look like a boy. Hell, maybe they should think about getting hitched. Getting back to his car, Jim first drove to Sanders' shop, only to find the gate locked up and the building dark. The police were indeed gone, but apparently so was Goody. Next, Jim took Sunset Boulevard west to Virgil Avenue, and then he followed the street numbers until he came to the address Goody had given to Moreland. He triple-checked the address and also those of the neighboring buildings. There was no doubt this was 214 North Virgil, but this was not a house or an apartment building. It was a small Mexican restaurant. Maybe he'd heard wrong. Goody could have said 240. Jim drove three blocks up until he reached that address, a Richmond station. As much as Goody loved cars, Jim couldn't imagine him in a service station. Could he have said 214? To cover every base, Jim headed toward where 214 North Virgil would be, if it existed, but the street inexplicably turned into Hillhurst at the 1200 block. "What kind of game are you playing, Goody?" Jim wondered aloud. With no other alternative, he returned home, arriving barely later than usual. Della was already gone. He hoped that she was having a good time. Finding a can of chili in the kitchen cabinet, he upended it into a pot and he put it on the stove. Then he pulled out the telephone directory and he did what he should have done as step number one. Look up Osgood Sanders. There was no listing for Osgood, Goody, or even O. Sanders. No phone address, no address, no Goody, Jim uttered. His impulse was to call Moreland back and find out when Goody was coming in tomorrow, but he doubted the detective would still be there. Getting back to the kitchen, he popped open a beer, and he sat at the small table, eating the chili straight from the pot. It was hardly gourmet, but there were many times when he was sitting in a foxhole somewhere in Europe, waiting to kill or be killed, when he would have given anything for a bowl of hot chili con carne instead of some cold, fatty meat from a tin. He was washing the pan when Della got back. "I thought you said you were getting a bite out, too," she said. "Plans changed, but this was fine. How was the film?" "I probably should have picked another one. It was a crime drama with Robert Mitchum playing an ex-GI who meets a girl singer in a club and tries to get her away from her mobster boyfriend." That described the situation that propelled Jim and Della together. "Think we should sue for plagiarism?" he asked. Sliding her shoes off, she said, "At least I never had to endure a nightclub brawl like in the movie, where a guy got a bottle broken over his head and then another one was thrown through a window. How's your case coming?" "I suppose it could be a bigger mess, but I'm not sure how." He related to her the events of the day, and then he added, "I'm going to call Moreland first thing tomorrow and find out when Goody is supposed to come. I think I'll be there, too. How about you, by the way?" "The detective, what did you tell him?" "That you sing me to sleep every night." She used that old musician phrase again, only in this context it seemed more appropriate. It was sometime between 2:30 and 2:45 in the morning, as Jim was lying down in his own bed, half asleep, that he finally got it. He sat straight up, and the noise was from the awakened Della. "What is it? Another nightmare?" she asked. "No. I think some smoke just blew out of my head." He got up and went into the living room, where his jacket rested, and he retrieved the photo. Then he turned on the light. Studying it closely, he muttered, "And there it is. Damn." Now Della appeared in the doorway, squinting against the light. "Are you all right?" she asked. "Yeah, I'm fine," he said. "I just figured out a lot of things all at once." "Will you be staying up?" "I want to jot down my thoughts before I forget them. Then I'll come back to bed." 10 minutes later, Jim slid the covers next to her, his mind clearer than it had been in days. Instead of going back to his own bed, he crawled into Della's. Comforted by her warmth, he fell back to sleep. By 7 o'clock, though, fully awake and in daylight, Jim's wee hours theory seemed almost ridiculous. At least he wanted to believe so. After showering, shaving, and dressing, he put in a call to Moreland, who told him that Goody Sanders promised to be there by 10:30. "Has the morgue figured out what kind of club was used on Hundley yet?" Jim asked. "Think so," the detective replied. "Tiny shards of glass indicate it was a bottle. I figured as much." "You figured as much?" "I'll make a prediction, too. I'll bet Goody's not going to show up. That address he gave you is a phony." "So where is he?" Jim explained his suspicion, and he made two plans. Then he hung up, after telling Della he had a stop to make before going into the office, and he headed out. The gate in front of Goody's garage was still locked, but a quick walk around the block told him exactly what he needed to know. Goody's car was parked on a side street, going down a dirty alley behind the shop. He saw the back door Sanders had mentioned. Placing an ear against it, he could hear movement inside. Stepping back, Jim waited. About 5 minutes passed before Goody Sanders emerged, carrying a small, battered suitcase. "Hello, Corporal," he said, startling him. "Sarge, what the hell? What do you want?" "Well, for starters, I'd like to know what 214 North Ridgel business is all about." "Oh, that? Well, it's a place that I like to go to get something to eat." "But you don't live there. Why did you say you live there?" "Here? Well, what are you talking about?" "Well, you told me about this back door that's kept being locked from the outside." And then, Jim said, pulling the car photo and holding it up, "The funny thing is, there's no corresponding door on the inside of the garage, just a solid wall. How could that be?" "It couldn't be, unless the back door opens into a separate space, like maybe a small apartment." "Okay, so I live here too." So why did you give Moreland the dummy address? And why are you running out? Jim pointed to the suitcase. Forget about all that, Goody. Just tell me why you killed Lyman Huntley. Oh, Sarge, I thought we were friends. We were. That's why I gave you every benefit of the doubt, even when you weren't making any sense at all. Now that things are starting to make sense, I can't simply let you run away. But there's no way you can stop me, Sanders said. Sorry, Goody, but I think there is, Jim replied, pulling out his gun. You wouldn't. I wouldn't like it. But if I have to, I'll blow your little toe off. Make it hard to run. Now get back inside. Forcing him back into the building, Jim saw that the room had been turned into a tiny living space, with a cot shoved up against a corner, a table including a hot plate for cooking and an ice box. A pipe suspended from the ceiling was filled with empty clothes hangers, the clothes themselves no doubt inside the suitcase. In one end of the space was a narrow door. Does that lead to the garage? Jim asked. It leads to the bathroom, and the Jakes opened into the garage. Sanders said sourly. The door I keep locked during business hours. Jim closed the door behind them, and he switched on a light. Why did you do it, Goody? Why did you do it? Sanders dropped the suitcase and sat on the corner of the bed. I never should have gotten mixed up in this. I ran into Lye in a bar a couple of weeks ago. We hadn't seen each other in years, and we got to talking and drinking and a lot of both. When he found out I had a garage, he got all excited. He said he had a big score that he could cut me in on. He told me about his job in Hollywood, making models and all, and he explained this scheme to defraud a big rich producer and the model car. And then he confessed to owing a couple of grand in gambling debts, and if he didn't pay out of a hurry, he'd have to live to regret it. He asked if I'd cover the $2,000 for him until his big score came in. Did you? Yeah, I know. How dumb can a guy be? It was literally all the money I had in the bank. But he was an old friend, and he was in trouble. So what was I supposed to do? At first, my involvement was simply to lend him the dough and let him hang in his car in the garage so he could take a picture with it. But then he let it slip that I'd learned from my old sergeant was now a private detective, and he got all excited over again. He told me to get you involved as a witness, and he said that the car had been stolen, and I didn't want to lie. But he said that if I didn't play along, I'd never get my money back. You still haven't told me why you killed him. You still haven't told me. Well, I told him that, and then he said the same. I don't know if I can make you understand. Try. Well, early Sunday morning, I woke up to hear someone pounding on the door. And it was Lye, and he was in a state. He found out that his Mark, the producer, was out of the country, so the deal was off. At least it was delayed, but Lye was running out of time. He said he was just going to skip before they got to him. So I said, fine, skip, toodle-doo, just return my $2,000 first. He said he didn't have it. The jerk had lost it in a game, too. In fact, he was coming back to ask me for more money to finance his bus ticket. Well, I lowered the boom on him. I told him that I hadn't spent the last 4 years in that awful place only to come back and get taken for a sucker by a guy that I had thought was my friend. And then, do you know what he did? Do you know what he did? He started laughing at me. And he was laughing, and he laughed, and then he called me a sucker for going off to fight in the war. He actually said that I was an idiot for allowing myself to be drafted. He said it, that I was an idiot to allow myself to be drafted. He said everyone who served in uniform was a fool. And he said that those who had died were the biggest fools of all. He actually said it. Sanders pulled out a cigarette, and he lit it with a shaking hand. And I snapped, Sarge. He went on. I got so mad that I grabbed an empty motor oil bottle and I broke it over his head. All I wanted to do was to stop his laughing. I didn't want to kill him, but he fell down and then he started twitching and then he fell still and there was glass all over the place and I was picking it up and then I was picking it up. It fought back. He lifted his bandaged finger. I should have lammed right there and then, but I didn't have any money either. I had to finish up a job on a Nash just to get paid enough to keep eating for a week. I worked all night with Lai's body sprawled on the floor a few feet away. I used a work lamp because I was afraid if I turned on the lights, somebody might come in. And then the next morning, you showed up and you saw the body before I had a chance to dump it somewhere. And, well, here we are. Here we are. Everything you told me up to now is a lie. Goody, you played me for a chump. You probably laughed at me behind my back, too. No, I swear. Look, just let me go, okay? If you have me tell to your friend the cop, at least give me a couple of days before you do it. I can't, Kitty. I can't let you go. You've killed a man. Sarge, so have you. It's not like we didn't kill people in the war. In the war, we had no choice. But now we do. It's different. Only thing different are the uniforms of the enemy, Sanders said. That's the only thing different. Bitterly, he said, come on, Sarge. Please, give me a break. After what we went through, together, the cold, the mud, the fatigue, the bullets, the bombs, old blood and guts yelling at us like we were fighting dogs. All you got to do is lower the gun, turn around, and walk out of here. Would that really be so hard, Sarge? Would that really be so hard? Goody asked. And a loud, sudden pounding came to the door, and it startled Sanders. It's open, Detective, Jim called. And Rand Moreland and two uniformed officers entered the room with their guns drawn. Turning back now to Sanders, Jim said, no, Corporal Goody, it wouldn't be that hard. And then he lowered his gun, turned around, and he walked out of there. That was the short story, Take Me for a Ride, written by the author Michael Mallory and read from here at the Talking Information Center. Read for the Talking Information Center's short story program. And this is the short story, Go Fish. And this short story was written by the author James Patrick Fockerill. Go Fish, James Patrick Fockerill. I launched the line behind the breakers, and I sat on a small bench, and I planted my rubber boots into the cragged shoreline. Surf casting at 5:30 a.m. was my guilty pleasure. But something was off about it this time. In the distance, a motorized inflatable raced toward the beach, plus 30 yards away from me stood a guy built like a cargo tanker, and the rest of the area was deserted. Was it a delivery? Was there a delivery about to happen? I left the bench, and I waded towards the thug. He looked over. He looked at me. I stopped. I reeled in my line, and I cast again. He approached me. Leave, he said. I'm sorry, I said. Leave, he said again. I'm sorry, I asked again. Fish someplace else, he said. This is a public beach, I answered him. He squinted. Not today, it isn't. Beat it, he said. My 55-year-old body couldn't take him, so I reeled in the line. But this is my lucky spot, I said. He sneered at me. Scram, he said. We both walked away, me toward my Subaru, him toward the boat. I stowed my gear. I sat in the car. The boat's driver handed over a large cooler, then sped away. I grabbed my badge and my 9mm from the glove box, and I headed for the thug. When I reached him, I flashed my badge. Police. I raised my gun. Open it. The cooler was filled with stripers. You gonna arrest me over fish? I smirked. No, just confiscating them. That night, when I cleaned the stripers, I discovered $1 million in uncut diamonds. Quite a haul. 1 week later, I retired to Mexico. All I left behind on my office desk was a yellow sticky note, and it read, Gone Fishing. That was the short story, Go Fish, written by the author James Patrick Fokerill. And that short story was read from here at the Talking Information Center, read for the Talking Information Center's short story program. And before that was the short story, Take Me for a Ride, written by the author Michael Mallory. And this has been the Talking Information Center's short story program, having been read from here at the Talking Information Center. Thanks a lot for listening, everyone. And please take care and goodbye, everybody.